SonicStates.com.
Hello and welcome to Sonic Talk number 42. We had a brief break last week. John Bowen, creator of the Solaris synth, I hope anybody had time to listen to that 50-minute epic interview that we did with him. Some very nice chap. But this week we're back with a force. We've got with us Mr. PJ Tracy from Minneapolis. How you doing, PJ?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I know it's quite an unholy hour where you are, but what is it, 8:15 in the morning?
Yep.
You're sounding very fresh. Actually, last time we spoke, you weren't sounding quite so fresh, so it sounds like maybe you had a good night's sleep tonight, last night.
I did, and I've been up for a couple of hours.
Okay, and we've also got Dave Spears from GeForce Software. How are you, Dave?
I'm all right, actually. Sorry, I'm just lighting a cigarette.
I'm not sure you should say that for our younger listeners.
You're not allowed to do that.
In England, you're not allowed to smoke in the workplace, and this is technically a workplace.
Ah, okay, I'll put it out then.
Insert effect. Dave, you're in the middle of more universal binary releases.
Yes.
For your plugins. Excellent. What was it this week? Oddity?
Oddity this week,
yeah. Oh, good. I'll have to...
Hopefully, Mini Monster next.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that'll be the last one. Yay!
We've also got John Musgrave. How are you, John?
I'm doing well, thank you. Good afternoon.
Been busy, I hear?
Yeah, very busy.
And also Mark Tinley. How are you, Mark?
Hello, I'm ill.
Yeah, I heard
you've been very ill.
Mark's had... What did you have? A lung infection?
I have got a lung infection. I've been on antibiotics for a week.
Oh, blimey.
And I've been taking lots of dextromethorphan as well, which is actually night nurse, but sounds more impressive if you say that.
Just the one lung that's infected or both?
Oh, I don't know. It's all very painful as well.
Oh, nasty.
Girlfriend's got the day off work as well. She's got it as well. She's just off to the doctors with the baby in a minute.
Oh, no. Well, I hope your baby doesn't get it either.
He's on antibiotics as well. We're all green goo people, so...
Oh,
he
really?
Hasn't had it as bad as me, but yes.
So you're single-handedly contributing to the superbugs in the local water supply?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Right. Okay, then. Well, Mark, I thought we could kick off with you because you sent me something about MacDiscount. Which I thought was quite fun. What is it? Basically, what you said was that people who work for McDonald's actually get more discount than journalists and anybody else who gets friends and family. Is that right?
It seems so. I was in McDonald's the other day and there was a big poster up and it was all this kind of come work for McDonald's. And then it said, if you join us, you get a 17% discount on Apple stuff in the Apple store. And I looked at it and I thought, hang on a minute. And I, Duran Duran, have a sort of endorsement deal with the Apple store, and they get a 10% discount. So from day one, when you started McDonald's, they give you 17%, which is almost double what they're giving artists, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's a bit odd.
Well, it's more than friends and family. It's more than people who work for Apple get as well. I think they get friends and family is around about 15%. So
15, yep.
Yeah, so wow. So actually, if you worked it out, if you were going to buy like a couple of Mac Pros, like real seriously specced up, you got through the interview process and got a quick job at McDonald's, worked there for a couple of days, ordered your Mac and then left, you could actually, and you'd get paid.
Would you like fries with that?
That form of... And you get those free if you work there.
Can I supersize it for you?
Yeah, I'd like extra RAM, please, and one of those eight core processors.
Eight processors, please.
I've always maintained that once someone gets you on a date rate, you're probably much better off working in McDonald's, because as we all know, music days don't last for 8 hours, do they? So
not generally, no.
When they go, well, how much an hour? Oh, well, we'll give you a day rate of this, and they sort of multiply it by around 10. And when you've been there about 16 or 17 hours, you start thinking,
okay, 2 days,
I should have done that.
Does anyone know what the National Union of Journalists discount is for Mac stuff?
I think it's 10 or 15%, I believe. I think 15% is as much as you can get.
In the US, there's an educational discount where you can get 15% off of any purchases through your university or high school.
Mm. Hey, do you think
that applies here as well, yeah.
So do you think it works the same way around? Do you think Apple employees get discounts on McDonald's products?
I suppose the irony is there's a picture of Bono in the middle of the poster in the middle of an iPod. He's sort of on a video iPod. And he only gets 10% discount, doesn't he? Wow.
That's okay, though, because he pays less tax than everyone else, doesn't he?
Well, that is
true. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
any tax, he's in Ireland, isn't he? He doesn't pay any.
No. For those who don't know, if you're an artist or creative person in Ireland, I don't know if this still holds true, but if you're a resident there, they don't charge you any income tax.
So, I'm moving to Ireland.
Yeah, lots of people do move to Ireland, and that's why.
I'm going to move to Ireland and work in McDonald's.
Yeah, move to Ireland, work in McDonald's, and then get taxed on your income. But, yeah, I think you've got to qualify by having a big bunch of cash. You can't just turn up and kind of go, right, I'm not paying any tax. I mean, I think you have to sort of contribute.
You two are pretty cool, actually. They have that huge studio that they let people come along and use for free, and they help lots of artists develop and stuff. So, and I think they put money into the Arts Council and all sorts of stuff. So even though they don't pay tax, they really do help the rest of the musicians and the rest of the Irish sort of economy.
You spend a bit of time in Dublin.
Yes, Mr. Costello's place. The most surreal time was the last time I went out to Elvis's place. There's a space next to me in the plane, and Elvis had paid, and it was all business class and whatnot. And just as the door shut, this guy ran on, bounded over me, got into the next seat, and it was Bono. And I was looking at him going, so, hang on a minute, Enya's going to be the trolley dolly, and Edge is probably flying on this.
So did you have much of a chat?
Yeah, I did, actually, yeah. His phone went off as we were taking off, and I went, bloody hell, it's usually a drummer.
Are you allowed to use your phone in business class?
Well, I wasn't.
You're just allowed to use your phone if you're Bono?
Yeah.
Right. Well, he's probably a regular, isn't he?
Yeah, a lot shorter than I imagined him to be.
They always are.
Yes. He's not quite as short as Prince, though, is he?
No.
Who was the guy who wrote the song?
Randy Newman?
Randy Newman wrote a song about short people, didn't he? He's not very fond of them. Is he very tall, or is he short too?
He looks like he's pretty short and quite squat.
Maybe then he was being
just
ironic.
Being ironic.
Yeah.
I think he's being ironic.
Yeah, okay. I can feel myself descending into the hole in the ground I'm digging here, so I'm going to move on to the next one. Dave, this might interest you, because obviously now you've got your rolling out your universal binaries, you're probably breathing a bit of a sigh of relief that Leopard, the Apple new operating system, has been delayed a little bit. Is that right?
Yes, yes, yes. My God. And the fact that they even talked about it is like, manna from heaven.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
so you actually...
so tight-lipped.
For the first time, you've actually got some idea of the schedule.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So are you seeded with Leopard? I mean, can you kind of still continue your work on it?
No.
Oh, you're not?
No. We get kind of heads up on in terms of the AU validation stuff, but, I mean, in terms of, anything else, including the, what they're calling the killer features, no one has any idea, I think.
Oh, I see, but...
Well, there's a rumour going around that there are no actual killer features, that they're sitting there going, kind of going, we've got to come up with something. Tell you what, let's get the phone out first, and we'll think about it in the interim.
There was a on the story on saying the latest version they'd seeded had more bugs in than the previous version.
Oh, really?
That was the rumour.
I heard somewhere that it crashed at a demo.
At a trade show.
Yeah, and that's very unusual for Apple stuff, mm-hmm. So maybe... But, I mean, they're kind of playing it as we've only got so much time to do these things. It's like there's a couple of guys in the back room and they're being pulled off working on OS 10 on Leopard.
To
work on the phone to get it out quicker, It's kind of... I wonder what's going on. It doesn't make them look too good, just purely because if they've been that wrong and they can't cope with they've either underestimated the amount of work it takes to finish Leopard, or they've underestimated the amount of work it needs to do the iPhone. So either way, they can't really be looking that good. And obviously, one thing that Non-Eric pointed out when I sent the show notes out was this means that Logic 8 is going to be delayed till at least October as well. So we're not going to see any kind of door love from anybody, really. I mean, imagine nobody's going to be wanting to put out major upgrades to any software that runs on OS 10 until this is out in the world. So are we going to see a sort of stasis for software development?
I like this. This is good. It means I don't have to upgrade anything. I can just work. It's fantastic.
I think the whole thing just indicates that the phone is more important to them. And it's maybe they just don't want to say that in public. But, I mean, like the iPod's become their important product. The iPhone could be their next really important product. And for ages people have been saying that their computers don't really shift the number of units that they want them to. And... maybe they're just banking on the phone being the thing which makes them a lot of money in the future.
Well, it's understandable.
It's a much bigger market, isn't it?
I mean, it's a huge market. It's hundreds of millions of units, isn't it? I mean, it's just kind of an enormous amount. And given the kind of slight Emperor's New Clothes aspect that kind of comes in with any new Apple product. You know, people pay a premium for it. And in fact, they're going to do it. If they can do that for a phone, then the potential number of units they could sell, I mean, they could be quids in, couldn't they? Apps or dollars in, depending on how you look at it.
The other thing is that I know that the kind of the 8-core announcement didn't get much fanfare, you know?
Apparently, it's quite hard to utilize because you don't get a doubling of, or, you know, it doesn't increase
proportionately.
Right. It's just a bit more. There were some tests, I think, on, I forget where it was, CNET or one of the major tech sites, and they just said, you know, it's actually the limiting factor now is the RAM. The RAM can't move the data fast enough to take care of all the additional cores.
The other thing is, of course, that the heat produced by the CPUs has been reduced, but the heat produced by the RAM is still a problem, right? I mean, this.
Well, I suppose so. Yeah, I don't know. Does RAM get very hot?
Extremely.
It does now. Yeah, because it's running faster than ever, and you need to have coolers on the RAM, right?
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, while we're on the Mac, there was something else. Oh yeah, media centers. I know. Did we talk about this before? Because I know Dave, you got an ITV, didn't you?
Yeah.
Have you figured out how to actually use it in your system so that your family can use it and not just you?
Yes, that was the whole idea of getting it, because obviously I've got all the photos here on the G5, and people talk about things that have happened, and I think, oh yeah, I only saw that picture the other day. So I just wanted it so that I could sling all the iPhoto stuff on there, and they had access to it on the TVs.
Right.
It's great, except for the fact that it only plays iPhoto's slideshows. So you can't scroll through to, you know, the folder you want and go, okay, I just want to look at that picture or this picture. So it has some limitations. And the hard drive isn't massive. I think, what's that, 20 gig?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of hacks.
There are hacks. You can apparently you can hack it so it'll just boot a full version of OS X. You can hack it so that it'll play DivX movies. You can hack it so that it'll, I don't know what else. I'm sure there's other things you can do. So it's kind of, you know, it could be kind of fun if you're into that sort of thing.
Does it have a TV tuner in it?
No, it hooks up to iTunes. I mean, because I did the same thing, because I bought an LCD TV finally, because my old Sony was just dying. And I got an LCD TV, and I thought, right, I'm going to get a Mac Mini and try and do the media center thing so that we can get rid of the video recorder and all that. And I've plugged it in, and it sort of all works. But the only problem is the only way you can control it is through this through the Apple remote. And when you've got kind of a remote for the telly, a remote for the video that's still there, a remote for satellite, and this Apple remote, and then my girlfriend going, so how do I just watch a video? It's not integrated, and it's really unfortunate because I was kind of quite excited and thought it'd be really good, but it's nearly good, but it's just not quite. It just needs a big red button.
Have you got a Bluetooth phone?
I've got a Bluetooth phone.
There's a piece of software called Saling Clicker.
Yeah.
Salling that controls all of these media things, and you load it onto your phone, and it's got templates for all the different bits of software, like QuickTime, and it's even got one for Logic Audio, actually. So you can start and stop Logic Audio from your telephone. It's kind of weird, but...
No, actually, this makes perfect sense, because one of the things that I've done is I got this media center, because the other thing I thought, my daughter likes to, you know, play on the BBC website, CBeebies. It's really good for little toddlers and stuff. So I've got a little wireless keyboard and a mouse, and the wireless keyboard doesn't work anymore. So rather than have a QWERTY keyboard that you've got to find somewhere to put, if you had a remote control that was just like a keypad of a mobile phone, as well as all the transport controls... So you could input, you know, text, because you might just sort of go, I want to record something, and you can name it with the text keypad like a keyboard. Because, I mean, we're used to that protocol. You know, my girlfriend texts all the time. Anybody, you know, most people text. It could do everything with a media center kind of PC, because I have to go, oh, no, you switch the TV into this mode. Then you switch the, you know, you press and hold the button on the Apple remote to bring up the front row. And it's just too much.
Has anyone seen anything yet that they really think's getting near to cracking this concept? Because it doesn't feel like it to me. Too many disparate parts, you know?
Yeah, there are too many disparate parts. And the whole thing about, you know, it's like if my girlfriend or my daughter can just kind of take a video and stick it in the video player, and then the TV automatically knows that it's getting an input from the SCART and goes, yeah, this is what you're watching. You know, all that stuff is, you have to have it, really. And it's, I mean, the one thing that I do really like about this is my Mac Mini's set to download all the Sonic stuff. So So, you know, from Frankfurt Messe or the Top 20 Simps or any of that stuff, I can actually watch that on the TV. And now we're starting to render all of our things at 640x480 for MP4. It actually looks pretty good. And it's kind of like
that's cool.
No, I mean, the other thing is with kind of using, if you've just got a DVD machine and a screen, you know, it's actually pretty quiet. The equipment is quiet. It doesn't make any sound. Whereas as soon as you get into sort of the realms of using PCs and Macs and computers for doing that sort of thing, they inevitably make more noise.
Yeah, that's true.
That's not very good if you just want a kind of media experience, in inverted commas. The last thing you want is some fan whirring in the corner or DVD drive making a lot of noise.
The Mac Mini is very quiet. I mean, the one thing I noticed mostly from getting an LCD TV is the terrible quality of broadcast imagery you get. You can see, because on a CRT, when you're watching on a tube, it kind of blurs all of the compression issues, so you don't see the blockiness so much. But I'm watching this thing, and I'm looking at stuff. I'm on Telewest, which is now Virgin, and the quality of the images coming down are appalling. I mean, really, really bad.
That's designed so that you want HDTV even more, isn't it?
So if you see something that's like a high-quality BBC program, which is maybe a nature program or whatever, the compression artifacts are much, much less obvious than if you're watching a crappy soap. Or I'm amazed, you know, that people are putting up with it.
I think hair just looks really weird on soaps, where they've shot it on video and then compressed it and stuff. It makes people's hair look like it's made out of plasticine.
Yeah.
there's an issue with plasma televisions and DVD compression. If you watch DVDs on plasma TVs, they look bloody awful.
They look really good on LCDs, though, I have to say. Dave,
yeah, they do.
You've got an LCD TV. Have you noticed that the poor quality of broadcast imagery?
It's funny. I bought one of the Sony, you know, digital and analog CRT jobbies. Yeah. And in digital, low light is crap. I mean, it must be something to do with compression or something. Because, you know, whenever I was kind of... I was looking at, I think I was watching like, I don't know, 24 or Lost or something. And every time there was a kind of dark scene, everything became really pixelated. And I was like, well, is that a crappy camera? Or, you know, what's going on? And then obviously when we got the flat screens, it was pretty much exactly the same.
And gradients and stuff. I mean, so that's something that's very disturbing because, I mean, everybody's going, this TV looks rubbish. And I'm thinking, oh no, I've just spent all this money on it. And my girlfriend and our lodger's going, it looks really sort of milky and sort of a bit blurry. It's not, you know, what's all this blockiness?
It may have something to do with the native aspect ratio of HDTV, which is 16:9. And so anybody using a camera that doesn't have native 16:9 capture has to do some major finagling to get the right aspect ratio. And it definitely changes the flavor of the picture. So, like, I don't know about something like Lost. I would imagine they have the budget, you know, of the century, but something like a crappy soap or maybe even, you know, well, not a BBC nature program. They're probably using, you know, high definition cameras as well, but something like a soap or a talk show would most likely have to upconvert to 16:9 from some other aspect ratio. Mm-hmm. And that would most likely affect your pixelization.
I'm 99% sure that any of the stuff that's broadcast in this country is broadcast as MP2.
Right.
Yes.
Like BBC One, BBC Two, etc. They're all MP2 because you can rip the stream.
If I remember correctly, talking to one of the techies here, he was saying that there's actually no facility for audio crossfades in MP2, so you can get all sorts of glitches and whatnot.
But we can safely say that the media center, home media center, is really not there yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I do think for £200, this Apple TV is good. I'm going to do the hacks this week.
Well, last week, I got an email from Dave Spears, and he basically heard from this guy, Malcolm Cecil, who was one of the Tontos Expanding Headband guys. You've been in communication with him. You know, how long ago did you meet him, Dave?
Probably about 10 years ago.
About 10 years ago, and they kind of keep in touch. And anyway, this story came up that one of his customers, because he's selling CDs through his MySpace site, suggested that they'd seen the Grammy from Inner Visions, Stevie Wonder's Inner Visions Grammy, on eBay, and thought it was a bit strange because, you know, they wondered whether maybe Stevie was, you know, a bit skint or just, I don't know, they just thought it was a bit funny. So they mailed Malcolm and said, oh, hey, I saw this. Is this right? And Malcolm decided to phone Stevie on a number that he had from him, you know, like 15 years ago, because I don't think they've worked together for an awfully long time. Happened to get through to him, mentioned it to Stevie, and Stevie says, no, somebody stole a bunch of stuff from my office some time back, and that was one of the things that went. So one thing led to another, and they tried to stop the auction, couldn't stop it because the original theft hadn't been reported. So the auction went ahead, and it went for $32,750. They're still, you know, figuring out who gets to be prosecuted and, you know, well, why they got it, and there's all sorts of subterfuge behind that. But the person who bought it was none other than Stevie Wonder's PA. So he bought it back after having it stolen for all that time, and it was just and Malcolm was kind of quite, he was put out that basically this poor guy had his stuff nicked and had to pay such an enormous amount for it to get it back, because the cops obviously couldn't do anything about it. I guess he's got the money, but I think that's about the gist of the story. There's really not much to say anymore after that.
Except for the fact that he got scammed a few years back. I want to say it was 7 or 8 years ago, and I wish I could remember. I didn't have time to research this, but I remember distinctly reading that somebody was approaching celebrities and asking for donations of rare artwork, rare photographs, and money for some bogus charity, and Stevie ended up writing a large check and sending some rare memorabilia to this person, and then found out later that it was a scam and ended up suing that individual, and I believe winning the lawsuit. But so this is seems to be a pattern, unfortunately, in his life.
Well, I mean, you know, there is a disadvantage, and obviously because he's not sighted, he's you know, unless he's got a kind of minder with him at all times, he's kind of a disadvantage, really, I suppose.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is usually the case for Stevie. I mean, he normally has an entourage of minders, doesn't he?
Yes, well, I mean, when we saw him at NAMM, there were an awful amount of people around him, which I would have thought, you know, I mean, he's like mobbed by his own people, which kind of must be, I suppose, I don't know what it's like, because I'm not, you know, not partially sighted or anything. I mean, PJ, it must be kind of quite disconcerting to be sort of in close proximity to lots of people all sort of hustling and bustling around. I mean,
it would be for me. I don't care for crowds for that reason, because they're difficult to visually navigate. But Stevie's entirely blind, so I'm not exactly sure. I suppose it depends on your personality.
You must be used to it by now, I guess. So,
yeah.
But yeah, terrible story. I mean, but Malcolm Cecil is famously the guy who owns Tonto. Well, it's called Tonto, which is the enormous cabineted synthesizer. Can you tell us anything about that, Dave?
Yeah, it's bloody massive.
Right, thank you.
No, it's funny because it's probably the machine that got me into synthesis. I mean, I didn't really know anything about it at all, but I fell in love with those, you know, Electric Lady Session albums. And years later, to come across somebody like Malcolm is like, and he's a British guy who moved to South Africa for health reasons. He needed to be in a warm climate, didn't like the regime over there, so he ended up moving to the States. And I think he's 70 this year, but an absolute genius. I mean, so many musos I know have tried to sort of, you know, play, I don't know, the bass lines to Boogie On Reggae Woman and stuff, and failed miserably. And actually Malcolm revealed probably about a year ago that the way it worked was that, you know, Stevie would play the lines and they'd just be tweaking knobs and moving stuff. So in effect, there's like, you know, six hands on this instrument. So that's how it's got all the movement in it and everything. I think so is the sublime synth.
Got to be down to the operators. I mean, because presumably, I mean, because it's so modular, I mean, God knows, you could get lost in there quite easily, couldn't you?
Oh, completely, yeah. I mean, Malcolm's a really fascinating character. In fact, it's really weird because when I was doing research for the Keyfax books, I was having to trawl through loads of mags, and I found this whole thing on him in, I think it was January 84, this big thing in Keyboard magazine. And just the way he thinks, you know, it's just brilliant. He tries to keep the whole engineering, because he is an engineer, but he keeps that side of things completely separate from the musical side. And he just talks about, you know, a synthesizer is kind of something that you have to climb inside the head of the musician to play. You know, it's not something a piano player is going to sit down at and stuff. And this, you know, these are things that we've thought about and thought were right for years and years. So this article's been on my walls for probably about 10 years now. It's like a mantra for us.
A lot of the stuff that Tonto was used on, I mean, is just sublime, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of classic electronic, you know, elements, but it's very organic at the same time.
It really is. I mean, you know, stick me in front of a Mini Moog and I'll immediately try and come up with a patch like, you remember the Isley Brothers, Living for the Love of You, and all those kind of tones. That was all Tonto.
And it's all up together again now, because, I mean, the actual machine itself was kind of, I mean, it's, how old is it now? It must be 30, 40 years old.
And
it's
sort of started it in about 69, I think he started building it.
I'm guessing, you know, it's probably needed a bit of repair here and there.
Oh, yeah, completely. I think it's a... In fact, I believe that's why him and Bob Margolef split up, is that, you know, Bob kind of saw it as a bit of a millstone, whereas, you know, Malcolm's always seen it as a complete asset.
Yeah, yeah. So what does he do? Does he have it in his kind of in his back bedroom or something?
No, I think he has a rather nice studio.
Yes, I'd imagine. Well, they won. He won 5 Grammys, right? Or, you know, for co-production or production or whatever on several seminal albums. So,
and where others kind of are always going on about, you know, oh, I got into electronic music via, you know, Jean-Michel Jarre or Vangelis, yeah, or Frank Ellis, as he's known around here. You know, for me, it was always those albums.
If you want to read more of the story, we put something up about it last week, and I thought we'd got the scoop because we got the inside track. Dave very kindly asked Malcolm if we could put the story up, and we did put it up. Yeah, go and read it on Sonic State. Anyone want to talk about mixer feedback music?
That was cool.
That was cool.
I like that. Yeah, I quite like that.
On the the Music Thing blogspot, there was a video of a guy basically playing a mixing desk, and it was... I think what he was doing, I mean, because I tried some of this, and he was essentially making a noise out of patching mixers how they shouldn't do, so that there was lots of electronic feedback. And this was an old mixer. It was called a Top Gear mixer that had kind of a load of reverb and stuff in it. So it's quite nice. And I thought, I wonder how hard it can be. So I had a go myself, and I've got, as you know here, I've got a little Behringer, a Behringer Xenix 1204. I plugged the output of auxiliary send into an input channel and then just messed around. And here we go, I'll just play it for you a bit.
Ooh.
As you can hear, it's a little bit difficult to control, but...
I better not let Nick Rhodes in having my job.
And
it's really good. I really like it.
I prefer that to the other one.
Yeah,
me too.
Yeah, it's much, much better, yeah.
Oh, well, thank you very much. But essentially, all I did was do that. And, you know, then all I did really was wiggle the fader about, which seemed to affect the sort of level of clipping. It's sort of kind of quite square wave, distorted square wave kind of thing. And then just messed around with the EQ. And that was it. And I was just thinking, you know, if you had a desk with multiple auxiliary sends on it and a few effects units, you could kind of almost get into additive synthesis. You know, it sounds a bit like one of those Metasonics pedals. You know, it's quite kind of, although this is obviously totally digital because it's a Behringer desk and it's, you know, there's nothing analog about it. There's no valves in it. So, I mean, I suppose it's analog in the sense that it's discrete electronics. But, so I think everybody should try it at home.
Well, I followed a link from the original page which you sent us about Sonic Picnic in Plymouth in England.
Right.
On the 22nd to the 25th of June. And that looks like it's a Sonic Arts Festival, basically. But that look, you should take it there and go and do a show.
Well, do you think I should submit a demo tape? But I was just thinking, I mean, imagine, you know, if you had like, you could almost, I mean, take it to a logical conclusion. You could book a studio which had, say, I don't know, a 72-channel SSL with I don't know how many auxiliary sends and groups they've got on them. And you could almost get a different sort of tone on each fader. And just by very small movements, you could create all sorts of mad textures, I would have thought, just using a mixing desk without any...
And you could automate it if you used an SSL. Fantastic. So, I like to say
That's better than the guy on this video. I thought it was a bit boring, to be honest.
I like the warm. They had a kind of fuzz to it. That distorted reverb's kind of quiet.
The reverb on it, yeah.
But you know,
I mean, he should have kicked it a few times as well.
Yeah.
It's all a bit too polite. Wasn't it?
It was very pedestrian.
You know who he reminded me of, Nick, was the guy that you interviewed for Going Solo, who does all of the sound effects work.
Yes, I can't remember what his name is now. Michael Oster.
He has a podcast where he's making sounds that are very similar to that, you know, just shaping noise and feedback and making all kinds of wacky textures.
Yeah, it's quite popular, and he's got a lot of work doing big film sounds. So maybe what I should do is just let everybody shut up. I'll just put a few more loops of feedback loop in, and maybe I'll get a gig doing the sound for, I don't know, the next big science fiction blockbuster like he did.
Pirates of the Caribbean 3.
Yeah, or whatever. 8, I think they're up to now, aren't they? I mean, I've never really thought of mixing desks as being able to generate sound themselves. You know what I mean? Apart from hiss, obviously.
Got a Behringer mixer upstairs, I'll have a go.
It doesn't have to be a Behringer, it could be anything. Maybe, you know, a Mackie sounds different, or maybe, you know, I'm sure they all have their own sound. So, you know, maybe we can try that out. Maybe next week we can come in with our homework.
Actually, what you played sounds very much like the Minimoog, you know, the loop feedback where you take the output and then route it back through the Minimoog.
Oh,
turn
well.
The gain up, turn the overdrive up. So, yeah, I'll do that, and then we'll do the Bath Festival this year.
Okay, brilliant. I'll turn up with my Xenix 1204.
I wonder if you can do it in Logic. You must be able to do it in Cubase or Logic as well.
Oh, what, so using digital feedback? Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah. It's sort of the routing out, and it should be possible. Yeah, I'm definitely doing Pro Tools, actually.
It won't sound as good as analog feedback, will it?
I think the problem you're going to get with that is because there are steps, effectively, there'll be an increment, you know, there'll be a point at which it just is all on and a point when it's all off. Because one thing I found when I was doing it with this mixer was it's, you know, very fine adjustments will change the pitch and the tone. Or, you know, just suddenly it'll just go into scream mode, and as you hear, you know.
I've got another trick for you as well, actually. If you take your signal and you pan it hard left and right,
yeah,
and then you take a copy of that signal and you reverse its phase and put it up the middle, it will cancel the middle and make the sound appear to go really wide on the speakers.
Well, unfortunately, I haven't got any phase on my my Xenix, but if I had a bigger console, in fact, I don't think I've got any mixing equipment that's got phase reverse anymore. Maybe I need a phase reverse
module. You have to make a special lead.
Yes, that's right, like the old days. A special phase reverse lead. There we go. One to try at home, but do remember, don't put headphones on, or if you do, turn it up very, very slowly. And turn your speakers down, because you can get some pretty wild and uncontrollable signals there.
The new N6 music production synthesizer.
From Yamaha. Codename
Minimo. The 61 note portable synthesizer with incredible sonic power based on motive tone generation, real time audio control, USB connectivity, and computer integration. Bundled with Cubase LE audio and MIDI sequencing software. Create,
produce, perform
with the affordable and versatile N6. Music production synthesizer
from
www.mm6music.co.uk.
That was the ad there for the Yamaha Minimo synth. Quite a lot of power under the hood, and one of the lowest cost of their range for all that motif action. If you want to help us look good, then by all means click on the link in the ad, which is mm6music.co.uk.
SonicState.com.
Another thing, music thing, Blogspot, who seems to be coming up with some crackers at the moment, he found a video of Quincy Jones and Herbie Hancock messing about in a studio with a Fairlight. And it's all very jazz-tastic, I suppose, but it's a brilliant piece. I'll just play a little bit.
You are sculpting. You're sculpting. Just like in a synthesizer, they're taking a pure electric signal and sculpting it into something of beauty.
I think Herbie there is playing the... did anyone spot what synth that was? We thought it might have been a Rhodes Chroma.
Yeah, I've got this somewhere on VHS. And I think it was a Quincy Jones special on like South Bank, Melvin Bragg thingy. Because I seem to remember they did a load of stuff with Herbie and then, you know, James Ingram's and all that lot. But actually... When Herbie starts playing, it's phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a great player. It takes him a little while to get into the groove, but...
I was just going to say, does anyone know which year this is, roughly? Sort of 1980-ish, is it?
Or I reckon it's about 84.
It's got to be about 84, because that's a Fairlight 2, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah. I think.
And he would have been working on sort of Rocket-era stuff at that point, wouldn't he?
It sounded like
Future,
it, didn't it?
Future Shock, yeah.
Yeah, Future Shock.
I can't understand his music, I have to say. I've got to have a rant now. I can't understand how he can write such a cool record like Rocket, which has got to be like the seminal sort of, you know, pop hip-hop record of all time. It was huge, wasn't it? And it sort of turned me on, certainly, to hip-hop kind of production and that way of thinking. And then he plays all this weird kind of like too many ninths and too many thirteenths sort of music as well, and it's like, how can he do that really cool thing which is so programmed and so precise and then all this wiggly stuff. What's that about?
You mean jazz?
You mean jazz?
That
yeah.
one, yeah, jazz.
Oh God, I love Herbie Hancock. I've got everything that he's ever recorded. Just fantastic stuff. So I don't know, Mark. I can't agree.
What that, should Mark listen to stuff. Next?
Oh, well, I love the old Headhunters stuff.
Yeah, that's something you should listen to. Yeah. Mark, you should listen to Headhunters, because that's basically where all the breaks came from for Massive Attack, at least, and the rest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I can't get past a few. I mean, the music he's playing in this, I listened to it because it was a documentary, and I sort of coped with it because I wanted to hear the information about, you know, what they'd been up to and everything, but... All of that, it drives me nuts.
Doesn't work for you. Yeah, I mean, I must admit, it wasn't exactly a pop record, was it? But, I mean, to demonstrate the... is it Page R? Is that what it's called in the sequencer, where he's with the light pen and he's switching all the kind of... doing all the drum programming?
Oh, that's cool, yeah.
I suppose to summarise, it's Herbie Hancock and Quincy Jones messing around in a studio full of probably the most expensive equipment you could buy in the day.
Yeah.
And just kind of going, yeah, man, that's fantastic.
That Fairlight Series 2 phone was $42,000 at the time.
Wow. No, I like the way he sort of said someone had dropped it off the other day, like it was like a box of vegetables or something.
I think it's great to see him using that light pen on screen. I mean, that's over 20 years ago, right?
Yeah,
I suppose. Here we are 20 years later still using keyboards and, you know, like QWERTY keyboards and mice.
I just couldn't get over the fact that he did all of that stuff. I mean, I just thought he'd have somebody to do it for him, and he'd just be the guy who was playing the music, you know, because that's what
he's a notorious tech head. Always had been ever since. Like, if you read Quincy Trope and Miles Davis's autobiography for Miles Davis, he talks about how Herbie was always showing up at sessions and on stage with the newest, latest electronic gizmo, and he got into playing the Fender Rhodes and brought that to Miles and said, you know, I'd like to introduce this into your sound. And Miles was just wild about it. So that kind of was the beginning of fusion right there.
Right. Well, Herbie. I mean, he is Mr. Fender Rhodes, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he turned Keith Jarrett and Chick Corea and all those guys onto it. So
I understand what Mark's saying about jazz, and I can deal with Herbie Hancock, but I can't deal with Chick Corea and Keith Jarrett. I find that just a bit too abstract for my liking. In fact, somebody bought me a Chick Corea piano album, and I put it on for about 10 seconds, and I'm afraid I just threw it away because I just really couldn't deal with it at all. You know, I've already admitted to liking Weather Report, so I feel, you know, I got to draw the line somewhere.
Well, Herbie's, what was that, like 79, 78, The Sunlight and Feats Don't Fail Me Now albums? They were fantastic. Oh, yeah. Absolutely fantastic albums. Even now, they still stand up.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's an interesting thing here where they're looking at that, when they're picking sounds out. Some of the sounds they're playing off the keyboards there, it's like sample sounds. They're hilarious. They're sort of like duck noises and all sorts of stuff. But if you think back to sort of mid-70s when they were doing Headhunters, some of the synth sounds that generate, that sort of build up through those tracks are mad. Yet the music is still very sort of jazz and very jazz-influenced and funk-influenced.
So you've got me curious enough to go and listen to it now.
There's that mad sort of sound in the middle that builds up. Sounds like people are talking. Crazy sort of...
That's right.
Do you know what I mean?
His mad solo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a mini Moog, amazingly.
It's crazy sound.
Yeah.
Absolutely bonkers. It sounds like a bunch of people talking.
And Chameleon's really accessible. I mean, I don't think you'd have any trouble listening to that, Mark. It's not ninths and thirteenths and all of that. So,
check it out. I did have a bad a bad Herbie Hancock experience, and that was the Korg. I think it was 40th birthday celebrations at NAMM. They bussed us all out to this theater just outside Anaheim, and there was a big dinner, and you know, all of us. There was all the journalists and loads of people went out there, and it was fantastic kind of setup. Herbie Hancock came on. And, you know, I think he's a Korg endorsee. And he read some sort of poem that was a bad start. And it was really sort of a bit stupid, really. And he just came across and said all this sort of nonsense. And then he just played this really awful self-indulgent whittle for like three quarters of an hour. And it was embarrassing because, you know, obviously all the Korg people had to stay there. But everybody else, all the guests, left the building and just went outside and smoked cigarettes and drank free drink. And, it was quite painfully embarrassing. And then he did actually play some stuff from Rocket, which was really cool, even though he couldn't quite stick to the script. You know, he had to keep, you know, pushing the boundaries, as it were. But it was really, it was very uncomfortable. And it was a shame because I really I appreciate how great he is, but I was embarrassed for him that particular night.
Does anyone have the oddity?
Yeah.
Your oddity.
Yeah. I've got Herbie did us a load of sounds for it, which sadly I'm not allowed to release, but if anybody wants them, let me know and I'll send them through.
Did he have a relationship with Bill Clinton? Was he one of those kind of one of Bill's music, a bit like the sort of
Maybe. My brother has a photograph with Bill Clinton. He was an intern at the White House press corps back in 1997. Mm. Yep.
Doesn't that mean he had to say no?
Most likely.
So anyway, but it's a great piece, and it's a you know, of its time. And I thoroughly recommend you watch it if you want. This it's a Spanish site, I believe, and it's just loads of pictures of kind of people in studios with their synths. But you know, lots of you know, fairly major type. You know, there's Vince Clarke in his kind of fantastic spherical studio, which is a brilliant shot. I don't think that still exists anymore. But I think one of my favourites has got to be Giorgio Moroder. Looking all the world like one of those guys off the 118 ads, but without the running vest, sporting a fantastic moustache and those big sunglasses, sort of reaching out with a Moog system in front of him. That's one of my favourite shots.
And a good belly.
Yeah, and a sort of slightly too tight sort of nylon shirt.
My favourite one, I don't know if I can pronounce it, is a man called Vladimir Sadchevsky, yeah. And it's some sort of 50-year-old, maybe, chap sitting in this, what looks like a radiophonic workshop with all dials and tape machines and wires everywhere. And I think he's a Russian sound designer, and I'm sure I read a piece about him in Sound on Sound about 7 or 8 years ago, maybe.
Anybody else have a favourite, John?
I saw the Vince Clarke one. I wondered where that was, actually. Where was that studio he had?
He had a studio in the middle of the country, didn't they? It was in a barn or something. Dave, do you know about that?
Was it in the UK, though? Or was it abroad?
It was in the UK.
Yeah, it was in the UK, yeah.
Okay.
It was in his garden.
Didn't he
but
have
not,
to... He sold
not
it all
anymore.
Off. No, he sold the house, didn't he?
Malcolm Cecil there. I quite like, what's his name from Toto, with his Damius Polyfusion thing.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that is the size of... Well, it's the whole wall, isn't it? I mean, it's huge.
Amazing.
And it looks like it's all flight cased up for touring or something.
Yeah, I think they did used to take it out.
Right. Steve Picaro there with his giant modular system. But yeah, some great shots. No explanation as to why they're there or what the context of them is. It's just like a gallery of funky shots of kind of total synth nuts in their environments, really. I suppose it's a bit sad, really, when you sort of try and describe it and make it sound good, and that's all it really is, isn't it? But it's...
I think the saddest thing is, on that Giorgio Moroder picture, I've worked out what everything is.
What's the mail pouch in the background, then?
What's the what? Ah, yes.
Something that says mail pouch on it. What's that all about?
I think it looks like a thermometer, doesn't it? Giant thermometer. For when Giorgio gets heated.
He's to keep his oscillator stable.
You know, you're probably right, actually, bizarrely. It's probably what it's for.
Really? It's like one of those things you put into a turkey. Or a joint of meat. Maybe not, no. I'll rephrase that, shall I? I tell you what, even better than rephrasing that, I'll just edit it out. So, well, thank you very much, everyone, this week. I know we've had a bit of a break, and we're back with Force, and same again next week. So thank you ever so much. Dave Spears from G-Force Music.
Thank you. Thank you.
PJ Tracy from Minneapolis. Actually, you've got some links for us this time, PJ. You'll be working on your website. We'll put the links in the show notes so you can go and see what PJ's up to.
Cool.
Thank you.
And John Musgrave, thank you.
Cheers, everyone.
And Mark Tinley.
Goodbye.
That was good. I like that. That was masterful. You've been in therapy for your goodbyes.
No, I've considered it. But
PJ sent me a track that was inspired by the Herbie Hancock thing. What did you use to play that? I'll just play a little bit there because it's kind of. It was Lounge Lizard. That's Applied Audio Systems. Lounge Lizard for the electric piano. That's going through RK Multimedia's Amplitude. And for the rhythm track, it's Spectrasonic's Stylus. And you rather imaginatively called it Sonic Shack, which I don't know if you know. We actually have sonicshack.com, and it used to be the place where we sold T-shirts and kind of sample CDs and stuff. So there you go. In a strange set of coincidences. So I'll use this to play us out, and that's us for this
week. That's cool. That's cool. That's more like Stevie Wonder kind of rhythmic kind of thing going on there than that Herbie Hancock.
Well, it's more. It's also a more organic electronic instrument, whereas I think perhaps the complex chords and stuff on a synthesizer can be a little bit sterile.
Yes.
So, PJ, thank you very much for that contribution, and we'll see everybody next week. I feel like a real DJ now. I actually had a fader and stuff. The Sonic Talk podcast is part of the Home Recording Network. You can see more podcasts of a similar nature at homerecordingnetwork.com.
SonicStates.com.